You did exactly right, said Gendebal. I have just said I would have done ill to have hurt him. You made it unnecessary to do so. You stopped him, and that was well done. I am grateful. She smiled again, blissfully. I see, then, why you have been so kind to me. I was grateful, of course, said Gendebal, a little flustered. But the important thing is that you must understand there is no danger. I can handle an army of ordinary people. Any scholar can, especially the important ones. And I told you I am the best of all of them. There is no one in the galaxy who can stand against me.
If you say so, Master, I am sure of it.
I do say so. Now, are you afraid for me?
No, Master, except... Master, is it only our scholars who can read minds, and are there other scholars, other places who can oppose you?
For a moment, Gendebal was staggered. The woman had an astonishing gift of penetration. It was necessary to lie. He said, there are none.
But there are so many stars in the sky. I once tried to count them and couldn't. If there are as many worlds of people as there are stars, wouldn't some of them be scholars? Besides the scholars on our own world, I mean?
No.
What if there are?
They would not be as strong as I am.
What if they leap upon you suddenly before you are aware?
They cannot do that. If any strange scholar were to approach, I would know at once. I would know it long before he could harm me.
Could you run?
I would not have to run. But, anticipating her objection, if I had to, I could be in a new ship soon, better than any in the galaxy. They would not catch me.
Might they not change your thoughts and make you stay?
No.
There might be many of them. You are but one.
As soon as they are there, long before they can imagine it would be possible, I would know they were there, and I would leave. Our whole world of scholars would then turn against them, and they would not stand. And they would know that, so they would not dare do anything against me. In fact, they would not want me to know of them at all, and yet I will.
Because you are so much better than they,
said Novi, her face shining with a doubtful pride. Gendebal could not resist. Her native intelligence, her quick understanding, was such that it was simple joy to be with her. That soft-voiced monster, Speaker Delora Delarmy, had done him an incredible favor when she had forced this Hamish farm woman upon him. He said, No, Novi, not because I am better than they, although I am. It is because I have you with me.
I?
Exactly, Novi. Had you guessed that?
No, Master, she said, wondering. What is it I could do?
It is your mind. He held up his hand at once. I am not reading your thoughts. I see merely the outline of your mind, and it is a smooth outline, an unusually smooth outline. She put her hand to her forehead.
Because I am unlearned, Master? Because I am so foolish?
No, dear. He did not notice the manner of address. It is because you are honest and possess no guile, because you are truthful and speak your mind, because you are warm of heart, and other things. If other scholars send out anything to touch our minds, yours and mine, the touch will be instantly visible on the smoothness of your mind. I will be aware of that even before I would be aware of a touch on my own mind, and I will then have time for counteractive strategy, that is, to fight them off. There was a silence for long moments after that. Gendebal realized that it was not just happiness in Novi's eyes, but exultation and pride, too. She said softly,
And you took me with you for that reason?
Gendebal nodded. That was an important reason, yes. Her voice sank to a whisper.
How can I help you as much as possible, Master?
He said, Remain calm. Don't be afraid. And just stay as you are. She said,
I will stay as I am. And I will stand between you and danger, as I did in the case of Rufirant.
She left the room, and Gendebal looked after her. It was strange how much there was to her. How could so simple a creature hold such complexity? The smoothness of her mind structure had beneath it enormous intelligence, understanding, and courage. What more could he ask of anyone? Somehow, he caught an image of Sura Novi, who was not a speaker, not even a second foundationer, not even educated, grimly at his side, playing a vital auxiliary role in the drama that was coming. Yet he could not see the details clearly. He could not yet see precisely what it was that awaited them. 59. A single jump, muttered Trevise, and there it is.
Gaia?
Asked Pellerat, looking over Trevise's shoulder at the screen. Gaia's son, said Trevise. Call it Gaia S, if you like, to avoid confusion. Galactographers do that sometimes.
And where is Gaia itself, then? Or do we call it Gaia P for planet?
Gaia would be sufficient for the planet. We can't see Gaia yet, however. Planets aren't as easy to see as stars are, and we're still 100 microparsecs away from Gaia S. Notice that it's only a star, even though a very bright one. We're not close enough for it to show as a disk. And don't stare at it directly, Genov. It's still bright enough to damage the retina. I'll throw in a filter. Once I'm through with my observations, then you can stare.
How much is 100 microparsecs in units which a mythologist can understand, Golan?
3 billion kilometers, about 20 times the distance of Terminus from our own sun. Does that help?
Enormously. But shouldn't we get closer?
No. Treviz looked up in surprise. Not right away. After what we've heard about Gaia, why should we rush? It's one thing to have guts. It's another to be crazy. Let's take a look first.
At what, Golan? You said we can't see Gaia yet.
Not at a glance, no. But we have telescopic viewers, and we have an excellent computer for rapid analysis. We can certainly study Gaia S to begin with, and we can perhaps make a few other observations. Relax, Janov. He reached out and slapped the other's shoulder with an avuncular flourish. After a pause, Treviz said, Gaia S is a single star, or if it has a companion, that companion is much farther away from it than we are at the present moment, and it is at best a red dwarf, which means we need not be concerned with it. Gaia S is a G4 star, which means it is perfectly capable of having a habitable planet, and that's good. If it were an A or an M, we would have to turn around and leave right now. Pellaret said,
I may be only a mythologist, but couldn't we have determined the spectral class of Gaia S from Seychelles?
We could, and we did, Genov, but it never hurts to check at closer quarters. Gaia S has a planetary system, which is no surprise. There are two gas giants in view, and one of them is nice and large, if the computer's distance estimate is correct. There could easily be another on the other side of the star, and therefore not easily detectable, since we happen, by chance, to be somewhat close to the planetary plane. I can't make out anything in the inner regions, which is also no surprise.
Is that bad?
Not really. It's expected. The habitable planets would be of rock and metal, and would be much smaller than the gas giants, and much closer to the star, if they're to be warm enough. And on both counts, they would be much harder to see from out here. It means we'll have to get in considerably closer in order to probe the area within 4 microparsecs of Gaia S.
I'm ready.
I'm not. We'll make the jump tomorrow.
Why tomorrow?
Why not? Let's give them a day to come out and get us, and for us to get away, perhaps, if we spot them coming and don't like what we see. 60. It was a slow and cautious process. During the day that passed, Treviz grimly directed the calculation of several different approaches and tried to choose between them. Lacking hard data, he could depend only on intuition, which, unfortunately, told him nothing. He lacked that sureness he sometimes experienced. Eventually, he punched in directions for a jump that moved them far out of the planetary plane. That'll give us a better view of the region as a whole, he said, since we will see the planets in every part of their orbit at maximum apparent distance from the sun. And they, whoever they may be, might not be quite as watchful over regions outside the plane. I hope. They were now as close to Gaia S as the nearest and largest of the gas giants was, and they were nearly 500 million kilometers from it. Treviz placed it under full magnification on the screen for Pellaret's benefit. It was an impressive sight, even if the 3 sparse and narrow rings of debris were left out of account. It has the usual train of satellites, said Treviz, but at this distance from Gaia S we know that none of them are habitable. Nor are any of them settled by human beings who survive, let us say, under a glass dome or under other strictly artificial conditions.
How can you tell?
There's no radio noise with characteristics that point them out as of intelligent origin. Of course, he added, qualifying his statement at once, it is conceivable that a scientific outpost might go to great pains to shield its radio signals, and the gas giant produces radio noise that could mask what I was looking for. Still, our radio reception is delicate, and our computer is an extraordinarily good one. I'd say the chance of human occupation of those satellites is extremely small.
Does that mean there's no Gaia?
No, but it does mean that if there is a Gaia, it hasn't bothered to settle those satellites. Perhaps it lacks the capacity to do so, or the interest.
Well, is there a Gaia?
Patience, Janov, patience. Treviz considered the sky with a seemingly endless supply of patience. He stopped at one point to say, Frankly, the fact that they haven't come out to pounce on us is disheartening in a way. Surely if they had the capacities they were described as having, they would have reacted to us by now.
It's conceivable, I suppose, said Pellaret glumly, that the whole thing is a fantasy.
Call it a myth, Genov, said Treviz with a wry smile, and it'll be right up your alley. Still, there's a planet moving through the ichosphere, which means it might be habitable. I'll want to observe it for at least a day. Why? To make sure it's habitable, for one thing. You just said it was in the ecosphere, Golan. Yes, at the moment it is. But its orbit could be very eccentric, and could eventually carry it within a microparsec of the star, or out to 15 microparsecs, or both. We'll have to determine and compare the planet's distance from Gaia S with its orbital speed, and it would help to note the direction of its motion. 61. Another day. The orbit is nearly circular, Trevise said finally, which means that habitability becomes a much safer bet. Yet no one's coming out to get us even now. We'll have to try a closer look. Tolleret said, Why does it take so long to arrange a jump? You're just taking little ones. Listen to the man. Little jumps are harder to control than big ones. Is it easier to pick up a rock or a fine grain of sand? Besides, Gaia S is nearby and space is sharply curved. That complicates the calculations, even for the computer. Even a mythologist should see that. Tolleret grunted. Trevise said, You can see the planet with the unaided eye now. Right there. See it? The period of rotation is about 22 galactic hours, and the axial inclination is 12 degrees. It is practically a textbook example of a habitable planet, and it is life-bearing.
How can you tell?
There are substantial quantities of free oxygen in the atmosphere. You can't have that without well-established vegetation.
What about intelligent life?
That depends on the analysis of radio wave radiation. Of course, there could be intelligent life that has abandoned technology, I suppose, but that seems very unlikely.
There have been cases of that, said Pallarat.
I'll take your word for it. That's your department. However, it's not likely that there would be nothing but pastoral survivors on a planet that frightened off the mule. Pallarat said,
Does it have a satellite?
Yes, it does, said Trevise casually.
How big?
Pallarat said in a voice that was suddenly choking. Can't tell for sure. Perhaps 100 kilometers across.
Dear me, said Pallarat wistfully. I wish I had some worthier set of expletives on instant call, my dear chap, but there was just that one little chance.
You mean if it had a giant satellite, it might be Earth itself?
Yes, but it clearly isn't.
Well, if Kompor is right, Earth wouldn't be in this galactic region anyway. It would be over Sirius way. Really, Janoff, I'm sorry.
Oh, well.
Look, we'll wait and risk one more small jump. If we find no signs of intelligent life, then it should be safe to land, except that there will then be no reason to land, will there? 62. After the next jump, Trevise said in an astonished voice,
That does it, Janoff. It's Gaia, all right. At least it possesses a technological civilization. Can you tell that from the radio waves?
Better than that. There's a space station circling the planet. Do you see that? There was an object on display on the view screen. To Pellerette's unaccustomed eye, it didn't seem very remarkable, but Trevise said, Artificial, metallic, and a radio source.
What do we do now?
Nothing for a while. At this stage of technology, they cannot fail to detect us. If, after a while, they do nothing, I will beam a radio message at them. If they still do nothing, I will approach cautiously.
What if they do something?
It will depend on the something. If I don't like it, then I'll have to take advantage of the fact that it is very unlikely that they have anything that can match the facility with which this ship can make a jump.
You mean we'll leave?
Like a hyperspatial missile.
But we'll leave no wiser than we came.
Not at all. At the very least, we'll know that Gaia exists, that it has a working technology, and that it's done something to scare us.
But, Golan, let's not be too easily scared.
Now, Janoff, I know that you want nothing more in the galaxy than to learn about Earth at any cost, but please remember that I don't share your monomania. We are in an unarmed ship, and those people down there have been isolated for centuries. Suppose they have never heard of the Foundation and don't know enough to be respectful of it. Or suppose this is the Second Foundation, and once we're in their grip, if they're annoyed with us, we may never be the same again. Do you want them to wipe your mind clear and find you are no longer a mythologist and know nothing about any legends whatever? Pallarat looked grim.
If you put it that way. But what do we do once we leave?
Simple. We get back to Terminus with the news, or as near to Terminus as the old woman will allow. Then we might return to Gaia once again, more quickly, and without all this inching along, and we return with an armed ship or an armed fleet. Things may well be different then. 63. They waited. It had grown to be a routine. They had spent far more time waiting in the approaches to Gaia than they had spent in all the flight from Terminus to Seychelles. Trevise set the computer to automatic alarm, and was even nonchalant enough to doze in his padded chair. This meant he awoke with a start when the alarm chimed. Pellerat came into Therese's room just as startled. He had been interrupted while shaving.
"Have we received a message?" said Pellerat.
"No," said Therese energetically. "We're moving."
"Moving? Where?"
"Toward the space station."
"Why is that?"
"I don't know. The motors are on, and the computer doesn't respond to me, but we're moving. Genoff, we've been seized. We've come a little too close to Gaia." Chapter 16. Convergence. 64. When Stor Gendebal finally made out Compor's ship on his viewscreen, it seemed like the end of an incredibly long journey. Yet, of course, it was not the end, but merely the beginning. The journey from Trantor to Seychelles had been nothing but prologue. Novi looked odd.
"Is that another ship of space, Master?"
"Spaceship, Novi. It is. It's the one we've been striving to reach. It is a larger ship than this one, and a better one. It can move through space so quickly that if it fled from us, this ship could not possibly catch it or even follow it."
"Faster than a ship of the Master's?"
Sora Novi seemed appalled by the thought. Gendebal shrugged. "I may be, as you say, a master, but I am not a master in all things. We scholars do not have ships like these, nor do we have many of the material devices that the owners of those ships have."
"But who can scholars lack such things, Master?"
"Because we are masters in what is important. The material advances that these others have are trifles." Novi's brows bent together in thought.
"It seemed to me that to go so quickly that a master cannot follow is no trifle. Who are these people who are wonder-having, who have such things?"
Gendebal was amused. "They call themselves the Foundation. Have you ever heard of the Foundation?" He caught himself wondering what the Hamish knew or did not know of the galaxy, and why it never occurred to the speakers to wonder about such things. Or was it only he who had never wondered about such things? Only he who assumed that the Hamish cared for nothing more than grubbing in the soil? Novi shook her head thoughtfully.
"I have never heard of it, Master. When the schoolmaster taught me letter roar, how to read, I mean, he told me there were many other worlds, and told me the names of some. He said our Hamish world had the proper name of Trantor, and that it once ruled all the worlds. He said Trantor was covered with gleaming iron, and had an emperor who was an all-master."
Her eyes looked up at Gendebal with a shy merriment.
"I unbelieve most of it, though. There are many stories the word-spinners tell in the meeting halls in the time of longer nights. When I was a small girl, I believed them all. But as I grew older, I found that many of them were not true. I believe very few know, perhaps none. Even schoolmasters tell unbelievables."
"Just the same, Novi, that particular story of the schoolmaster is true, but it was long ago. Trantor was indeed covered by metal, and had indeed an emperor who ruled all the galaxy. Now, however, it is the people of the Foundation who will someday rule all the worlds. They grow stronger all the time."
"Will they rule all, Master?"
"Not immediately. In 500 years."
"And they will master the masters as well?"
No. They will rule the worlds. We will rule them for their safety and the safety of all the worlds."
Novi was frowning again. She said, "Master, do these people at the Foundation have many of these remarkable ships?"
"I imagine so, Novi."
"And other things that are very astonishing?"
"They have powerful weapons of all kinds."
"Then, Master, can they not take all the worlds now?"
"No, they cannot. It is not yet time."
"But why can they not? Would the Master stop them?"
"We wouldn't have to, Novi. Even if we did nothing, they could not take all the worlds."
"But what would stop them?"
"You see," began Gendebal, "there is a plan that a wise man once devised." He stopped, smiled slightly, and shook his head. "It is hard to explain, Novi. Another time, perhaps. In fact, when you see what will happen before we ever see Trantor again, you may even understand without my explaining."
"What will happen, Master?"
"I am not sure, Novi, but all will happen well." He turned away and prepared to make contact with Compor, and as he did so, he could not quite keep an inner thought from saying, "At least I hope so." He was instantly angry with himself, for he knew the source of that foolish and weakening drift of thought. It was the picture of the elaborate and enormous Foundation might in the shape of Compor's ship, and it was his chagrin at Novi's open admiration of it. Stupid! How could he let himself compare the possession of mere strength and power with the possession of the ability to guide events? It was what generations of speakers had called the fallacy of the hand at the throat. To think that he was not yet immune to its allures. 65. Munli Compor was not in the least sure as to how he ought to comport himself. For most of his life, he had had the vision of all-powerful speakers existing just beyond his circle of experience. Speakers with whom he was occasionally in contact, and who had in their mysterious grip the whole of humanity. Of them all, it had been Stor Jendebal to whom in recent years he had turned for direction. It was not even a voice he had encountered most times, but a mere presence in his mind, hyperspeech without a hyper-relay. In this respect, the second foundation had gone far beyond the foundation. Without material device, but just by the educated and advanced power of the mind alone, they could reach across the parsecs in a manner that could not be tapped, could not be infringed upon. It was an invisible, indetectable network that held all the worlds fast through the mediation of a relatively few dedicated individuals. Kompor had more than once experienced a kind of uplifting at the thought of his role. How small the band of which he was one, how enormous an influence they exerted, and how secret it all was. Even his wife knew nothing of his hidden life. And it was the speakers who held the strings. And this one speaker, this Jendebal, who might, Kompor thought, be the next first speaker, the more than emperor of a more than empire. Now, Jendebal was here, in a ship of Trantor, and Kompor fought to stifle his disappointment at not having such a meeting take place on Trantor itself. Could that be a ship of Trantor? Any of the early traders who had carried the Foundation's wares through a hostile galaxy would have had a better ship than that. No wonder it had taken the speaker so long to cover the distance from Trantor to Seychelles. It was not even equipped with an unidock mechanism that would have welded the two ships into one when the cross-transfer of personnel was desired. Even the contemptible Seychellian fleet was equipped with it. Instead, the speaker had to match velocities and then cast a tether across the gap and swing along it, as in Imperial days. That was it, thought Kompor gloomily, unable to repress the feeling. The ship was no more than an old-fashioned Imperial vessel, and a small one at that. Two figures were moving across the tether, one of them so clumsily that it was clear it had never attempted to maneuver through space before. Finally, they were on board and removed their spacesuits. Speaker Stor Jendebal was of moderate height and of unimpressive appearance. He was not large and powerful, nor did he exude an air of learning. His dark, deep-set eyes were the only indication of his wisdom. But now the speaker looked about with a clear indication of being in awe himself. The other was a woman, as tall as Jendebal, plain in appearance. Her mouth was open in astonishment as she looked about. 66. Moving across the tether had not been an entirely unpleasant experience for Jendebal. He was not a spaceman, no second foundationer was, but neither was he a complete surface worm, for no second foundationer was allowed to be that. The possible need for spaceflight was, after all, always looming above them, though every second foundationer hoped the need would arise only infrequently. Preem Palver, the extent of whose space travels was legendary, had once said ruefully that the measure of the success of a speaker was the fewness of the times he was compelled to move through space in order to assure the success of the plan. Jendebal had had to use a tether three times before. This was his fourth use, and even if he had felt tension over the matter, it would have disappeared in his concern for Sura Novi. He needed no mentalics to see that stepping into nothingness had totally upset her.
"I be afeared, master," she said, when he explained what would have to be done. "It be notness into which I will make footstep."
If nothing else, her sudden descent into thick Hamish dialect showed the extent of her disturbance. Jendebal said gently, "I cannot leave you on board this ship, Novi, for I will be going into the other, and I must have you with me. There is no danger, for your spacesuit will protect you from all harm, and there is no place for you to fall to. Even if you lose your grip on the tether, you will remain nearly where you are, and I will be within arm's reach so that I can gather you in. Come, Novi, show me that you are brave enough as well as bright enough to become a scholar." She made no further objection, and Jendebal, unwilling to do anything that might disturb the smoothness of her mindset, nevertheless managed to inject a soothing touch upon the surface of her mind. "You can still speak to me," he said, after they were each enclosed in the spacesuit. "I can hear you if you think hard. Think the words hard and clearly one by one. You can hear me now, can't you?"
"Yes, master," she said.
He could see her lips move through the transparent faceplate, and he said, "Say it without moving your lips, Novi. There is no radio in the kind of suits that scholars have. It is all done with the mind." Her lips did not move, and her look grew more anxious.
"Can you hear me, master?"
"Perfectly well," thought Jendebal, and his lips did not move either. "Do you hear me?"
"I do, master."
"Then come with me and do as I do." They moved across. Jendebal knew the theory of it, even if he could handle the practice only moderately well. The trick was to keep one's legs extended and together, and to swing them from the hips alone. That kept the center of gravity moving in a straight line as the arms swung forward in steady alternation. He had explained this to Sura Novi, and without turning to look at her, he studied the stance of her body from the set of the motor areas of her brain. For a first-timer, she did very well, almost as well as Jendabal was managing to do. She repressed her own tensions, and she followed directions. Jendabal found himself, once again, very pleased with her. She was, however, clearly glad to be on board ship again, and so was Jendabal. He looked about as he removed his spacesuit, and was rather dumbfounded at the luxury and style of the equipment. He recognized almost nothing, and his heart sank at the thought that he might have very little time to learn how to handle it all. He might have to transfer expertise directly from the man already on board, something that was never quite as satisfactory as true learning. Then he concentrated on Kampor. Kampor was tall and lean, a few years older than himself, rather handsome in a slightly weak way, with tightly waved hair of a startling buttery yellow. And it was clear to Jendabal that this person was disappointed in and even contemptuous of the speaker he was now meeting for the first time. What was more, he was entirely unsuccessful in hiding the fact. Jendabal did not mind such things on the whole. Kampor was not a Trantorian, nor a full second foundationer, and he clearly had his illusions. Even the most superficial scan of his mind showed that. Among these was the illusion that true power was necessarily related to the appearance of power. He might, of course, keep his illusions as long as they did not interfere with what Jendabal needed, but at the present moment, this particular illusion did so interfere. What Jendabal did was the mentalic equivalent of a snap of the fingers. Kampor staggered slightly under the impress of a sharp but fleeting pain. There was an impress of enforced concentration that puckered the skin of his thought and left the man with the awareness of a casual but awesome power that could be utilized if the speaker chose. Kampor was left with a vast respect for Jendabal. Jendabal said pleasantly, "I am merely attracting your attention, Kampor, my friend. Please let me know the present whereabouts of your friend Golan Treviz and his friend Janoff Pellerat." Kampor said hesitantly, "Shall I speak in the presence of the woman, speaker?" "The woman, Kampor, is an extension of myself. There is no reason, therefore, why you should not speak openly."
"As you say, speaker. Treviz and Pellerat are now approaching the planet known as Gaia."
"So you said in your last communication the other day. Surely they have already landed on Gaia and perhaps left again. They did not stay long on Seychelles planet."
"They had not yet landed during the time I followed them, speaker. They were approaching the planet with great caution, pausing substantial periods between micro-jumps. It is clear to me they have no information about the planet they are approaching, and therefore hesitate."
"Do you have information, Kampor?"
"I have none, speaker," said Kampor. "Or at least my ship's computer has none."
"This computer?" Jendabal's eyes fell upon the control panel, and he asked in sudden hope, "Can it aid usefully in running the ship?"
"It can run the ship completely, speaker. One need merely think into it."
Jendabal felt suddenly uneasy. "The Foundation has gone that far?"
"Yes, but clumsily. The computer does not work well. I must repeat my thoughts several times, and even then I get but minimal information."
Jendabal said, "I may be able to do better than that."
"I am sure of it, speaker," said Kampor respectfully.
"But never mind that for the moment. Why does it have no information on Gaia?"
"I do not know, speaker. It claims to have, as far as a computer may be said to be able to claim, records on every human inhabited planet in the galaxy."
"It cannot have more information that has been fed into it, and if those who did the feeding thought they had records of all such planets, when in actual fact they had not, then the computer would labor under the same misapprehension, correct?"
"Certainly, speaker."
"Did you inquire at Seychelles?"
"Speaker," said Kampor uneasily, "there are people who speak of Gaia on Seychelles, but what they say is valueless. Clearly superstition. The tale they tell is that Gaia is a powerful world that held off even the mule."
"Is that what they say indeed?" said Jendabal, suppressing excitement. "Were you so sure that this was superstition that you asked for no details?"
"No, speaker. I asked a great deal. But what I have just told you is all that anyone can say. They can speak on the subject at great length. But when they have done so, all that it boils down to is what I have just said."
"Apparently," said Jendabal, "that is what Treviz has heard, too. And he goes to Gaia for some reason connected with that, to tap this great power, perhaps. And he does so cautiously, for perhaps he also fears this great power."
"That is certainly possible, speaker."
"And yet you did not follow?"
"I did follow, speaker, long enough to make sure he was indeed making for Gaia. I then returned here to the outskirts of the Gaian system."
"Why?"
"Three reasons, speaker. First, you were about to arrive, and I wanted to meet you at least part way and bring you aboard at the earliest moment, as you had directed. Since my ship has a hyper-relay on board, I could not move too far away from Treviz and Pellerat without rousing suspicion on Terminus, but I judged I could risk moving this far.
Second, when it was clear that Treviz was approaching Gaia planet very slowly, I judged there would be time enough for me to move toward you and hasten our meeting without being overtaken by events, especially since you would be more competent than I to follow him to the planet itself and to handle any emergency that might arise.
Quite true. And the third reason?
Since our last communication, Speaker, something has happened that I did not expect and do not understand. I felt that, for that reason, too, I had better hasten our meeting as soon as I dared.
And this event that you did not expect and do not understand?
Ships of the Foundation fleet are approaching the Seychellian frontier. My computer has picked up this information from Seychellian news broadcasts. At least 5 advanced ships are in the flotilla, and these have enough power to overwhelm Seychelles.
Gendebal did not answer at once, for it would not do to show that he had not expected such a move, or that he didn't understand it. So, after a moment, he said negligently, "Do you suppose that this has something to do with Trevise's movement toward Gaia?"
"It certainly came immediately afterward, and if B follows A, then there is at least a possibility that A caused B," said Campor.
"Well then, it seems we all converge upon Gaia, Trevise and I, and the First Foundation. Come, you acted well, Campor," said Gendebal. "And here is what we will now do. First, you will show me how this computer works, and through that, how the ship may be handled. I am sure that will not take long. After that, you will get into my ship, since by then I will have impressed on your mind how to handle it. You will have no trouble maneuvering it, although I must tell you, as you have no doubt guessed from its appearance, that you will find it primitive indeed. Once you are in control of the ship, you will keep it here and wait for me."
"How long, Speaker?"
"Until I come for you. I do not expect to be gone long enough for you to be in danger of running out of supplies, but if I am unduly delayed, you may find your way to some inhabited planet of the Seychelles Union and wait there. Wherever you are, I will find you."
"As you say, Speaker."
"And do not be alarmed. I can handle this mysterious Gaia, and if need be, the 5 ships of the Foundation as well."
67.
Littoral Tubing had been the Foundation's ambassador to Seychelles for 7 years. He rather liked the position. Tall and rather stout, he wore a thick brown mustache at a time when the predominant fashion, both in the Foundation and in Seychelles, was smooth-shaven. He had a strongly lined countenance, though he was only 54, and was much given to a schooled indifference. His attitude toward his work was not easily seen. Still, he rather liked the position. It kept him away from the hurly-burly of politics on Terminus, something he appreciated, and it gave him the chance to live the life of a Seychellian sybarite and to support his wife and daughter in the style to which they had become addicted. He didn't want his life disturbed. On the other hand, he rather disliked Leono Codel, perhaps because Codel also sported a mustache, though one which was smaller, shorter, and grayish-white. In the old days, they had been the only 2 people in prominent public life who had worn one, and there had been rather a competition between them over the matter. Now, thought Tubing, there was none. Codel's was contemptible. Codel had been director of security when Tubing was still on Terminus, dreaming of opposing Harlow Brano in the race for mayor, until he had been bought off with the ambassadorship. Brano had done it for her own sake, of course, but he had ended up owing her goodwill for that. But not to Codel, somehow. Perhaps it was because of Codel's determined cheerfulness, the manner in which he was always such a friendly person, even after he had decided on just exactly the manner in which your throat was to be cut. Now he sat there in hyperspatial image, cheerful as ever, brimming over with bonhomie. His actual body was, of course, back on Terminus, which spared Tubing the necessity of offering him any physical sign of hospitality.
"Codel," he said, "I want those ships withdrawn."
Codel smiled sunnily. "Why, so do I. But the old lady has made up her mind."
"You've been known to persuade her out of this or that."
"On occasion, perhaps, when she wanted to be persuaded. This time she doesn't want to be. Tubing, do your job. Keep Seychelles calm."
"I'm not thinking about Seychelles, Codel. I'm thinking about the Foundation."
"So are we all."
"Codel, don't fence. I want you to listen to me."
"Gladly. But these are hectic times on Terminus, and I will not listen to you forever."
"I will be as brief as I can be when discussing the possibility of the Foundation's destruction. If this hyperspatial line is not being tapped, I will speak openly."
"It is not being tapped."
"Then let me go on. I have received a message some days ago from one Golan Treviz. I recall a Treviz in my own political days, a commissioner of transportation."
"The young man's uncle," Goodell said.
"Ah, then you know the Treviz who sent the message to me. According to the information I have since gathered, he was a councilman who, after the recent successful resolution of a Selden crisis, was arrested and sent into exile."
"Exactly."
"I don't believe it."
"What is it that you don't believe?"
"That he was sent into exile."
"Why not?"
"When in history has any citizen of the Foundation been sent into exile?" demanded Tubing. "He is arrested or not arrested. If he is arrested, he is tried or not tried. If he is tried, he is convicted or not convicted. If he is convicted, he is fined, demoted, disgraced, imprisoned, or executed. No one is sent into exile.
There is always a first time.
Nonsense. In an advanced naval vessel? What fool can fail to see that he is on a special mission for your old woman? Whom can she possibly expect to deceive?
What would the mission be?
Supposedly, to find the planet Gaia.
Some of the cheerfulness left Goodell's face. An unaccustomed hardness entered his eyes. He said, I know that you feel no overwhelming impulse to believe my statements, Mr. Ambassador, but I make a special plea that you believe me in this one case. Neither the mayor nor I had ever heard of Gaia at the time that Trevise was sent into exile. We have heard of Gaia for the first time just the other day. If you believe that, this conversation may continue.
I will suspend my tendency toward skepticism long enough to accept that, Director, though it is difficult to do so.
It is quite true, Mr. Ambassador. And if I have suddenly adopted a formal note to my statements, it is because, when this is done, you will find that you have questions to answer, and that you will not find the occasion joyful. You speak as though Gaia is a world familiar to you. How is it that you know something we did not know? Is it not your duty to see to it that we know everything that you know about the political unit to which you are assigned?
Tubing said softly, Gaia is not part of the Seychelles Union. It, in fact, probably does not exist. Am I to transmit to Terminus all the fairy tales that the superstitious lower orders of Seychelles tell of Gaia? Some of them say that Gaia is located in hyperspace. According to others, it is a world that supernaturally protects Seychelles. According to still others, it sent forth the mule to prey on the galaxy. If you are planning to tell the Seychellian government that Trevise has been sent out to find Gaia, and that 5 advanced ships of the Foundation Navy have been sent out to back him in this search, they will never believe you. The people may believe fairy tales about Gaia, but the government does not, and they will not be convinced that the Foundation does. They will feel that you intend to force Seychelles into the Foundation Federation.
And what if we do plan that?
It would be fatal. Come, Codel, in the 5-century history of the Foundation, when have we fought a war of conquest? We have fought wars to prevent our own conquest, and failed once, but no war has ended with an extension of our territory. Accessions to the Federation have been through peaceful agreements. We have been joined by those who saw benefits in joining.
Isn't it possible that Seychelles may see benefits in joining?
They will never do so while our ships remain on their borders. Withdraw them.
It can't be done.
Goodell, Seychelles is a marvelous advertisement for the benevolence of the Foundation Federation. It is nearly enclosed by our territory. It is in an utterly vulnerable position. And yet, until now, it has been safe, has gone its own way, has even been able to maintain an anti-Foundation foreign policy freely. How better can we show the galaxy that we force no one, that we come in friendship to all? If we take over Seychelles, we take that which in essence we already have. After all, we dominate it economically, if quietly. But if we take it over by military force, we advertise to all the galaxy that we have become expansionist.
And if I tell you that we are really interested only in Gaia,
then I will believe it no more than the Seychelles Union will. This man Trevise sends me a message that he is on his way to Gaia and asks me to transmit it to Terminus. Against my better judgment, I do so because I must, and almost before the hyperspatial line is cool, the Foundation Navy is in motion. How will you get to Gaia without penetrating Seychellian space?
My dear Tubing, surely you're not listening to yourself. Did you not tell me just a few minutes ago that Gaia, if it exists at all, is not part of the Seychelles Union? And I presume you know that hyperspace is free to all and is part of no world's territory. How then can Seychelles complain if we move from Foundation territory, where our ships stand right now, through hyperspace into Gaian territory, and never in the process occupy a single cubic centimeter of Seychellian territory?
Seychelles will not interpret events like that, Codel. Gaia, if it exists at all, is totally enclosed by the Seychelles Union, even if it is not a political part of it. And there are precedents that make such enclaves virtual parts of the enclosing territory, as far as enemy warships are concerned.
Ours are not enemy warships. We are at peace with Seychelles.
I tell you that Seychelles may declare war. They won't expect to win such a war through military superiority. But the fact is, war will set off a wave of anti-Foundation activity throughout the galaxy. The new expansionist policies of the Foundation will encourage the growth of alliances against us. Some of the members of the Federation will begin to rethink their ties to us. We may well lose the war through internal disarray, and we will then certainly reverse the process of growth that has served the Foundation so well for 500 years.
Come, come, Tubing, said Codel indifferently. You speak as though 500 years is nothing, as though we are still the Foundation of Salver Hardin's time, fighting the pocket kingdom of Anacreon. We are far stronger now than the Galactic Empire ever was at its very height. A squadron of our ships could defeat the entire galactic navy, occupy any galactic sector, and never know it had been in a fight.
We are not fighting the Galactic Empire. We fight planets and sectors of our own time.
Who have not advanced as we have. We could gather in all the galaxy now.
According to the Selden plan, we can't do that for another 500 years.
The Selden plan underestimates the speed of technological advance. We can do it now. Understand me, I don't say we will do it now, or even should do it now. I merely say we can do it now.
Cordell, you have lived all your life on Terminus. You don't know the galaxy. Our navy and our technology can beat down the armed forces of other worlds, but we cannot yet govern an entire rebellious, hate-ridden galaxy. And that is what it'll be if we take it by force. Withdraw the ships.
It can't be done, Tubing. Consider, what if Gaia is not a myth? Tubing paused, scanning the other's face as though anxious to read his mind.
A world in hyperspace, not a myth?
A world in hyperspace is superstition, but even superstitions may be built around kernels of truth. This man, Trevise, who was exiled, speaks of it as though it were a real world in real space. What if he is right?
Nonsense. I don't believe it.
No? Believe it for just a moment. A real world that has lent Seychelles safety against the Mule and against the Foundation.
But you refute yourself. How is Gaia keeping the Seychellians safe from the Foundation? Are we not sending ships against it?
Not against it, but against Gaia, which is so mysteriously unknown, which is so careful to avoid notice that while it is in real space, it somehow convinces its neighbor worlds that it is in hyperspace, and which even manages to remain outside the computerized data of the best and most unabridged of galactic maps.
It must be a most unusual world, then, for it must be able to manipulate minds.
And did you not say a moment ago that one Seychellian tale is that Gaia sent forth the Mule to prey upon the galaxy? And could not the Mule manipulate minds?
And is Gaia a world of mules, then?
Are you sure it might not be?
Why not a world of a reborn second foundation in that case?
Why not indeed? Should it not be investigated? Tubing grew sober. He had been smiling scornfully during the last exchanges, but now he lowered his head and stared up from under his eyebrows.
If you are serious, is such an investigation not dangerous?
Is it?
You answer my questions with other questions because you have no reasonable answers. Of what use will ships be against mules or second foundationers? Is it not likely, in fact, that if they exist, they are luring you into destruction? See here, you tell me that the Foundation can establish its empire now, even though the Selden plan has reached only its midway point. And I have warned you that you would be racing too far ahead, and that the intricacies of the plan would slow you down by force. Perhaps, if Gaia exists, and is what you say it is, all this is a device to bring about that slowdown. Do voluntarily now what you may soon be constrained to do. Do peacefully and without bloodshed now what you may be forced to do by woeful disaster. Withdraw the ships.